You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Tomares.
Mil campanas suenan en mi corazón. Qué difícil es pedir perdón. Ni tú ni nadie, nadie puede cambiarme.
That's enough, Fran. That's for Lauren Giles on Facebook sent us a message asking if every episode could open with a bit of singing from Fran Reyes. That's Fran Reyes. I'm Richard Moore. I'm not sure every episode will open with that, but that's for you. We're waiting for Daniel Freeb. He's going to join us soon. He had another puncture today in his car.
Yeah, so
extraordinarily bad luck.
It's almost as unlucky as Contador.
But we thought we'd start recording without him because he finds the tale of the Etapa very boring. And when I mentioned that, Fran, you said
too.
You do too.
I do too. I mean, only if I jump in and out
Is it generally when Lionel does it? Is it okay, or is it just me that you find boring?
Both cases, you know, when I'm listening to the podcast at home, I usually just scroll past it, you know.
Okay, I'm going to make it very quick. There was not a lot to say about today's stage. It was won by Matthew Trent in his third stage, sort of reinventing himself as a sprinter here. Though when you see some of the guys he's beating, it makes you realize that the quality of sprinters here isn't top of the league. It was a tough finish, actually. Very technical, very twisty, a bit of a climb as well just before the finish. It was perfect for him. He had fantastic help from Bob Jungels, Julian Alaphilippe in particular. There was a big break again today. Alexis Goujard, David Villela, Thomas de Gendt, of course, Arnaud Courtais, Alessandro De Marchi were all in that. Villela sat up after getting some King of the Mountains points and went back to France. You spoke to him at the finish.
Exactly. I spoke to him at the finish, you know, just to find out, because usually, you know, when you engage on these kind of adventures and if you decide to drop yourself after you are getting your goal, which in Bilala's case was the King of the Mountain points, the companions used to take a piece of you, on you, you know, used to yell at you and tell them that you are kind of betraying them by not accompanying them all the way until the end of the breakaway. But in this case, Villela didn't want to go deep into that topic with me. But he told me that he was looking to get some points for the King of the Mountain classifications and that he intends to fight for that prize all the way to the finish.
He wants to win it. Yeah. It's quite... he's off to Astana, so he's not in the same situation as a lot of his Cannondale Drapac teammates.
Like a last service for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's an odd one that he's in the King of Mountains. He's been very shrewd, very clever in picking up points where he's been able to. That's pretty much it for the tale of the Etapa. The break was caught. There was a... Well, it was a sort of bunch sprint, but Søren Andersen, the Sunweb rider, attacked on the climb. Yeah. He then finished third in the sprint, so very good ride by him. Gianni Moscon as well, second. Again, more of a strongman sort of finish, and he's obviously going extremely well. Very versatile rider, isn't he?
Yeah, Chris Froome made a point indeed about how he was in the peloton with Gianni Moscon come the final kilometer, and Froome himself told Moscon to have a go, to try and get the stage win, and he came very close indeed. But you know, Richard, earlier you were saying that this final was perfect for Matteo Trentin, but do you know who this final suited him best? Juan José Lobato.
But I saw a lot of his fans because he's from Andalusia.
Exactly, he's from Trebujena, which is a really small town, an hour drive maybe away from Sevilla, and his whole town loves him. You know, they follow him to every race they can. Indeed, when he finished the Tour de France in 2013, two buses from Trebujena made that one day long trip just to join him on the Champs-Élysées and greet him. And today, a lot of fans were there. Unfortunately, we
didn't do the Where Are We, but we are in Sevilla, and it's beautiful. And we've been to a lot of small places on this Vuelta. This is a big city, quite a big city. And there was a tremendous crowd and a great atmosphere at the finish. We were in one of the suburbs, really, of Sevilla, where the stage
Tomares,
finished.
Exactly, you know. And this is a really particular city. I mean, this is not the kind of city that I really love here in Spain, but there are there are two Sevillas. One is the normal, usual Sevilla, which is yearning to appear like something big. And the other one is the one we are staying at, which is Triana. This is the heart of Sevilla. This is the genuine Sevilla.
Daniel, I do apologize. We've done the tale of the etapa.
Oh, good. My God. I hate the tale of the etapa.
We thought we'd kick things off without you get that out of the way. It's pretty brief tonight.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, another dramatic day for
Daniel. It's been a long, tough old day. At the end of a long, tough old season.
These roads, roads from our hotel this morning were quite unbelievable. There was a couple of Fords as well I went through.
Yeah. Second puncture.
Different tyre, not the used tyre that you bought.
Important to point that out.
And this time, have you bought a new tyre or
we've got the spare on there. Going to have to change the car tomorrow. It's been a tough day. 40 degree temperatures. I've had a nosebleed. I've been involved in beef on social media.
You're getting a hard time for Nibali. We need a Ciro Scognamiglio intervention here, don't we? He needs some sort of couples counselling or something.
Ciro's colleague in La Gazzetta said that, I don't know what, he's completely misrepresented me. Anyway.
What Ciro's colleague has?
Yeah, Giza. Claudio Ghisalberti. Anyway.
Oh, God, dear, oh, dear. Things will have to be patched up at some point. Anyway, I mentioned in the tale of the etapa that you missed. I'll give you a brief summary, Daniel, while we're listening to this interview, because I did speak at the finish to a rider I don't know very well, Soren Anderson, the Sunweb rider who rode extremely well in that finale. You know, they're here for Wilco Kelderman, obviously, but he had his chance today, and he was third on the stage. Here he is at the finish.
Yeah, I looked at it this morning, even last rest day. The team said to me, this day can be something for you. And then since then, I support Wilco as much as I can, but also try to save energy in the Corpetto for today. So yeah, something we planned, yeah.
It was one of those, a sprint, but it was one where, you had to be up the front, didn't you? And you made it very hard, and Bob Jungels made it extremely fast as well.
Yeah, of course, it was today I had the chance and I had to show my level. So I'm happy that I could prove that the chance was well deserved. So
there aren't many chances on this Vuelta. Any others that you've picked out?
Not really. Madrid is maybe too fast and too flat for me. So now it's all about Wilco and the team.
You need it to be a little bit harder than just a straight flat finish.
Yeah, it has. There has to be a hill like today. And even also maybe the sprint uphill like today, then I'm better. Yeah.
Great, well done. So Soren Anderson, anything to say about the stage today, Daniel?
No, but I've got something to say about the beer that we're drinking. Fran might be able to help with this. Fran, we're drinking Cruz Campo. Is that a beer from the south, from Andalusia?
Yes, this is a beer from Sevilla, and I strongly advise you not to drink it outside of Sevilla.
Okay.
You know, here it tastes different and it tastes good. Outside of Sevilla is the lamest beer ever.
Okay, yeah. That was important to establish. Back to the race. I don't know about you chaps, but the guys I spoke to were shocked at how hard it was in the last 3 kilometres. Nicholas Roach he asked for permission to swear in his post-race interview. We didn't give it to him, but he was quite shocked and appalled by how difficult it was made by the racing, really, more than the terrain, and the heat, of course. And I was quite impressed that all of the GC guys, apart from David De La Cruz,
I meant to mention that he was caught in the wrong side of this, but ironically,
I was quite impressed that they all managed to cling on to the coattails guys going for the stage win.
You know, Contador, Froome, Nibali, all in the top 10, I think, weren't they, on the stage?
Yeah, and Chavez, Chavez was pretty close as well to those guys.
Remarkable.
Yeah. So, it was an awkward one for them. Of course, their thoughts are very much drifting towards the two big mountain stages this weekend, La Pandera and the Sierra Nevada. So they could easily have been caught out today and weren't. And interesting, Wilco Kelderman has snuck up, hasn't he, on the rails, and he's now fourth in general classification. I spoke to him this morning. He's really not he's not putting a number on it where he wants to finish. He's not overtly targeting the podium, but you would have thought with his time trialing ability and 40 kilometres of time trialing still to come, he might have an outside shot of finishing on the podium. I think he's facing literally an uphill struggle because La Pandera in particular is very steep. The Angliru is very steep in the last week, and I don't think they're particularly going to suit him.
it's I put it to Nicolas Portal, the Team Sky sports director, this morning that the Vuelta might be harder to win than the Tour in terms of every stage is on. We heard Michael Woods talk about this last night, the concentration required. Obviously, that is also required at the Tour de France, but it does seem more controlled, a little bit more controlled at the Tour. Here, it's anarchic. That finish today, as you say, was dangerous and narrow and twisting, and De La Cruz, you know, was caught out. Any of those riders could have been caught out. Just the mental energy required, the stress of that is enormous. And yeah, it's just more unpredictable. We saw that yesterday with Chris Froome's crash. He seemed okay today, a bit bashed up, and we got footage of the actual crash on the first crash that none of us had seen on the corner. A listener actually sent us that. Thank you very much for that. It was interesting. I watched the footage, actually. I showed it to Dave Brailsford, who we're going to hear from in the final part of tonight's podcast. And he had ridden the course, and he gave me a bit of false information because he told me that there was a digger parked at the sign. You can see a yellow vehicle there. And he said there was...
Not Digger Forum, was it?
he
was, but no wonder Froome lost his concentration.
Yeah, some people will get that, others won't. But he said there'd been work going on and there was mud on the road at that point. Somebody on Twitter said to me it was actually a fire engine rather than a local fire engine rather than a works vehicle. So I don't know, but he said that there was mud there and he communicated that back to Team Sky. You know, when you're descending at whatever speed they were going, it's difficult to... But he hit something, his wheel went, and apparently there were other riders in the Gruppetto who had problems on that same corner. So, but from the footage, Froome's front wheel just went from under him, and he fell pretty heavily, and it looked today like he was, you know, quite sore. So today, a bit of a test, and he did well, obviously, to finish up there at the finish today.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast and producing the wonderful Pedal de Charme t-shirts. And we will be awarding one of those tomorrow to the winner of week 2, Pedal de Charme. Daniel, you look confused.
I'm always confused by Pedal de Charme. We had this discussion at dinner last night, didn't we?
What constitutes Pedal de Charme?
I sort of contradicted. I was in a funny mood. I said, Pedal de Charme is rubbish. It's lost. Yeah, it's lost its soul. And then about 2 minutes later, I said, no, Pedal de Charme is great. It's the best thing we do.
It is.
I love it.
Well, I think this week has reminded me of that because the two front runners, Conor Dunn and Michael Woods, they've had the support of wives, girlfriends, teams, teammates. It's been great.
Conor Dunn is a tremendously nice fella.
He is a lovely fella, and he tweeted tonight, "My mum made my cousin show her how to use Twitter just so she could vote for me in the cycling podcast poll." Michael Woods said that if he won, he would donate his T-shirt to make a garment that might fit Conor Dunn's midriff. Right, might go towards a bigger garment that would actually fit the 6'8" Conor Dunn. I'm torn here because I have to say that the winner, very narrow winner, there were over 2,000 votes, was Michael Woods. It was nip and tuck. And one minute when I looked, it was Conor Dunn leading. The next minute, it was he had support of the Dave Rayner Fund. You know, big guns out in support.
Any votes
of Conor
for Nibali?
Dunn.
No, I thought not.
He'll be up for it next week. Anyway, so Michael Woods is our winner. I think on this occasion we're going to present 2 T-shirts. We don't have one in Conor Dunn's, sort of an extra long one for him here, but we will furnish him with a T-shirt. Definitely deserves one, I think. Thank you to everybody who voted for that. Now, in this part, I spoke to a couple people this morning. Quite interesting. Dave Brailsford from Team Sky, the principal Team Sky. They've signed an awful lot of young, promising riders this week. Chris Lawless was the latest one confirmed this morning, British rider. But earlier in the week, Pavel Sivakov, the Russian rider who grew up in France, who Nicola Portal...
Born in Italy.
Grew
up in France, but rides for Russia.
Russian parents.
His dad rode for Ros Lotto in the 90s.
Wow. Well, Nicholas Portal lives near him, or lived near him, and knew him well. And he said to me this morning that he arranged for him to join the BMC development team a few years ago. Sky have then nipped in and nabbed him. They don't have a development team. We'll hear Brailsford talk a little bit about that. They've also signed Egan Bernal, the Colombian who just won the Tour de l'Avenir, and Christopher Halverson, the under 23 world champion. A real quality group of young riders, arguably some of the best young riders in the world at the moment. So what's the plan? I thought I'd go and ask Dave Brailsford about that. Here he is.
Well, I think in general we've been looking at the sort of the demographics, if you like, of the team over the last last period for quite a while now, and we've been looking at the, you know, the challenge of winning now and making sure that you win in the present, but also thinking about the future, and you think about, do we develop riders in-house or do we wait, and do you transfer riders in at a certain level? And there's no doubt that we would all prefer, if possible, to develop talent through the team, and I think that's what been really thinking about. And I guess more and more it's pretty obvious that if you've got a group of world-class riders who are very focused on winning now, then you've got to really think quite long and hard about what kind of development opportunities and what kind of development pathway you can create in a team like ours. So we tend to think of the riders as either winning now, that's your job, to win now, helping somebody win now, or learning to win in the future. And we kind of expanded that out and spent a lot of time. Rod went back and looked at all the stuff that he did with the academy, and you know, we went back and looked at all of that, and you know, obviously we talked over the years to how Geraint and Cav and Swifty and Ian Stannard, Luke Rowe, all those guys develop. And so we decided to put some real focus and resource and proper attention on it. And that started with recruitment. So we've been looking quite hard for the last 12 to 18 months, really, tracking, you know, all of the best young riders in the world. And then this year was the opportunity to really, you know, bring some new young riders into the team to bolster the group that we've already got. So it's pretty exciting.
I think a lot of us, Sky are already one of the long-serving sponsors in the sport. Team sponsors don't tend to stick around for longer than 10 years. A lot of us imagine Sky would be gradually phasing out, perhaps, their involvement with the team. This suggests that you're very much planning for the long term or the medium term.
Yeah, I think you've got to. I think, you know, you've got to look at the medium to long term and plan accordingly. And I think it is a dichotomy insofar as, you know, you get judged on the here and now, you'll get judged on what happens today. And that very much dictates your future in many respects. But the reality is, I think you've got to separate it out, compartmentalise a little bit and think, OK, what do we want the future to be? And really think about what the sport might look like in 2025. What would we like it to look like? And then set about how we might be able to make that happen. So rather than waiting for it to happen to us, as it were, let's try and determine ourselves what we'd like to happen and then go and make it happen.
I mean, perhaps because Sky have been so focused on winning the biggest race in the world, they haven't earned a reputation really as a team that's developed a lot of talent. I mean, Luke Rowe is one, but there are other promising riders who've come into the team and maybe not developed as you would have liked. What are you going to do differently with these guys to make sure they do develop?
Well, I think you've got Luke Rowe, but I'd also say Geraint Thomas has been... I think from our perspective, I think we may see it slightly differently because, of course, we all worked, you know, majority of us worked at British Cycling beforehand, and obviously had the whole experience there with Rod and that development programme and the talent team in Britain. So I think we felt that we've, you know, with Swifty and Cav and all of that group, I think they did a very, very good job with that group. And I think we look at just how rounded and knowledgeable they are as riders, and you go back and think, well, where did that come from? How did they get that experience? And I think going back, we think actually we put a lot of effort into that, which we now need to replicate within the team. So instead of having an academy outside the team, what do we do inside? So I do think we've got some really good learnings, as it were. Not it's not going to work for everybody, and I think when you take young riders, you know, not everybody's going to make it all the way to the top. For some people it works, and some people it might not work so much. You know, so there's definitely going to be an attrition rate, and I think that was the case with, you know, the programmes that we've run in the past. But in the main, I think, in talking to the older guys, in talking to some of the younger guys, in talking to, you know, Teo's had a fantastic first year, for example. And it's very interesting in talking to him and seeing what his reflections are, and helping, you know, the answers, I think, lie with the riders, actually. They've got the most knowledge of what's worked and everything else. So rather than us thinking that we know everything, it's better to listen to them, really take on board what they say, and let them guide, you know, our thinking and the support that we want to put around these young lads to try and develop them.
And the original aim of the team was obviously win the tour with a British rider. You've got a Colombian, a Norwegian, a Russian, and a British rider, but it seems more international.
Well, I still think, you know, we're operating in a global sport, and as we grow, you know, I think that the global nature of the sport has become has had a bigger impact on us, and I think we do want to develop the future, you know, we want to develop future winners of the Tour de France, and I think we've got the British influence, and you know, I'm very, very proud to be British, and wouldn't want it any other way. But equally, we're operating, you know, like I say, in a global market, and we'd like to think of, you know, how does Team Sky develop within its ranks the future winners of the Tour de France, and more so as well. I think we've been looking at the whole, you know, what can we do as a team to support the junior development of, you know, the riders' development at the junior level in Great Britain and globally, and what could we do maybe given our position for at the under 23 level. You know, we've looked at having development teams, and I'm not convinced, I must say. I think our role might be one more of where we can share experience, share knowledge, coaches, you know, that kind of input into a broader group rather than just have a select sort of team. So we've got a program we've been looking at, and we're hopefully going to try and launch that next year, to really put something back into the sort of junior and 23 ranks in a much more proactive way.
We carried a story this week, a rare podcast exclusive, Movistar launching a women's team. That's an interesting development. I wonder, it's something you've been asked a lot over the years. Is that in your thinking as well?
Well, I think we've seen there's no doubt about it that the women's side of the sport is growing well, I'd say, and it's getting more TV time, it's getting more media, it's getting more coverage as it deserves. And our question is, how do we support that, and how do we engage with that? And again, we've got some ideas around that. You know, having a team is one way of doing it, but maybe there are different kind of approaches that we've been thinking about and looking at where we could add something into the development of the women's side of the sport.
So that was Dave Brailsford. I mean, we're familiar with, you know, obviously the work that Rod Ellingworth did, Daniel, with the British Academy, that produced Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas, Ben Swift, Ian Stannard, all these guys. And it seems like they want to recreate something like that within Team Sky.
Yeah, and it reminds me also of what MAPPE did in the last couple of years of their existence. They had, at one stage, I think they had 42, 44 riders on their roster, of which a good dozen were the best young riders in the world. So Fabian Cancellara, believe it or not, Filippo Pozzato was one of the best riders in the world. Back then, there were guys who you will have completely forgotten about, like Pavel Zerzan, who went on to do absolutely nothing. But they had this group that would ride races like the Tour de Chile, the Tour of Rhodes, and they really cleaned up. And
Charlie Wigelius was one of those.
He was, and it almost replaced the under 23 category for those guys. They'd all turned professional relatively early. The one thing I would say about creating sort of a capsule, a group of riders like that, is that, as we've mentioned before on the podcast, in cycling there is very little incentive to develop young riders, in the sense that, you know, there are no transfer fees, and a team like Sky is pretty clogged up with top talent, and the money slot, so the leadership in all of the main types of races, Grand Tours, Ardennes Classics, Cobble Classics, they're taken. So it's fairly easy to envisage a situation where some of those guys will have developed quite well 2 years down the line, but they will be frustrated and they'll want to move, and Sky will ultimately receive no benefit from having developed them and nurtured them. But I think it's still a very appealing thing to someone like Dave Brailsford, Rod Ellingworth, who have worked in development, who have worked in nurturing athletes. They still, there is a big part of them that wants to do that and love seeing young talent come to the fore.
You said that there is no incentive to develop riders, and it's true, but it's basically because developing talent means having a mid-term plan, and unfortunately cycling world lives on the short term. I think that we have great examples of how good scouting or good talent development is key for teams. For example, at Quickstep, we have now a generation of leaders with Julian Alaphilippe, Fernando Gaviria, Laurent Depluy, Enric Mas, and so on, that are going to be pretty important riders for Quickstep, even if they leave early. So, from what I can tell by my experience of working with development teams, it's also a matter of choosing the role that the riders are going to fulfill in the future. If you have, of course, you can have a pack of very good riders, of very great, brilliant winners, but some of them are going to become domestics. And if you really get to develop a domestic mindset, then development definitely makes sense, because he can be a teammate for 10 years.
Brailsford mentioned Theo Gegenhardt, who's turned pro this year and has done very well. A rare example, perhaps, of a neo-pro who's really shone in his first year at Team Sky and proved himself to be very, very versatile. He seems to have has that ability to step up. You know, he didn't win a lot of big under-23 races, but when you put him in harder races, apparently Ian Stannard was very complimentary about his performance at the Eneco Tour, for example. He's a slim, slender guy who looks and is a climber, but actually can really get involved in bunch sprints. He's a good bike handler. He's very good in those situations, and he's done really well. He seems to have really, really thrived. I say a rare example because you know, there haven't been many riders at Team Sky who, they haven't signed many really promising young riders, but Joe Dombrowski is the famous one, who joined as the baby Giro winner, and you know, that ended pretty badly.
Do you see what I mean, Risto, though? They don't, Sky of all teams do not need to develop young talent, and unless they're getting guys on 5-year contracts, because they simply can go and cherry pick the best riders at any given time. They don't need to have 22-year-olds on the roster. They're interested in winning the absolute top races in the world, and pretty much, you know, every rider will want to join them because they'll offer more than most other teams, and they'll offer a better environment than most other teams.
But I wonder if the catalyst for this is the Yates brothers, who famously slipped through the net at Team Sky and joined a team that did promise them a sort of longish term plan that they've followed through and have developed well. And I wonder if that experience has prompted this sort of change in policy.
There are good examples. I mean, there are teams that are doing it pretty well. Sunweb are a team that are doing it really well, and they've got really long-term plans, sort of 3-4 year plans that you almost think don't make sense when riders are only on 2-year contracts. But they did that with Dumoulin. They've done it with Barguil, for example. And you know, they've managed to keep those riders at least until the point where they're kind of cresting the wave. That was the case with Kittel, it's the case with Barguil, it's the case with Dumoulin, whatever he goes on to do now. So there is some benefit
to it.
Well, maybe
we're seeing it a bit more, actually. You know, Orica being a good example. At the end of my interview with Brailsford there, I also asked him about a women's team, whether Sky, you know, something we have asked him about a lot over the last 7 years. I don't know what people will make of his answer. It certainly fell very far short of any kind of commitment, even vague commitment, to set up a women's team. But I also this morning spoke to Javier Guillen, the director of the Vuelta, for a kilometre zero that's coming out on Monday. But I asked him about the Madrid Challenge, which is the Women's World Tour closer, the climax of the Women's World Tour on the final day of the Vuelta in Madrid, whether, like La Course at the Tour de France, there were any plans to develop that. Here's what he said.
Our responsibility is to help all cycling or road cycling in all terms, no matter all subjects. For sure, we would like to make Madrid Challenge bigger, but I think we have to go slowly, step by step. Madrid Challenge came up because 3 years ago, it was our 80th anniversary. So we decided just 1 year. We saw it work very good. Now, you know, it's absolutely established, the race. So now it's time to try to do something more. What that mean? To add 1 or 2 days to the race. No more. I don't see so far another 3 weeks for women, because I think it's too much. It's too tough in terms of logistic, economical terms. So I prefer to go a little bit. But in my model, in my plan, Madrid Challenge is a 3 day race.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast, and you can get 20% off at scienceinsport.com with the code CPAUG20. CPAUG20. So we heard just before, Fran's desperate to jump in here. He's got some factoid. We'll get to that in a second. I just want to mention second sort of almost scoop in a week for the cycling podcast with Javier Guillen there telling us, I don't think he said it to anybody else, about his plan for the Madrid Challenge to become a 3 day event. So that's exciting news. Like your news the other day, Fran, that Movistar are planning a women's team.
After all, these are two very good news for women's cycling, particularly in Spain. The women's cycling scene in Spain has been evolving quite fast during the last 5 to 10 years. There is a very good generation of talents coming along: Lourdes Ollarvide, Alicia González, Eider Merino, and of course Sheila Gutierrez and Ana Santisteban, who are already racing at top level. And I think Spain is going to become a powerhouse in the coming years in women's cycling. But, you know, we have been talking earlier about young talents signed by Sky. I have an anecdote I want to share with you and, of course, with our listeners about Egan Arley Bernal, Colombian rider, winner of the Tour de l'Avenir. I had a really nice long interview with him in the Tour of Castile León, and I asked him about his name, because neither Egan nor Arley are common names here in the Spanish speaking countries. And he told me where did that come from. Apparently
I hope you're gonna tell us now.
Maybe. Okay, yeah, I'm going to tell you.
Well,
it's
a competition.
Eh? No need for that. No need for that. It's just a tale, a beautiful tale, more fun than the tale of the tapa, for sure. So,
cheeky.
So apparently, their parents decided to let a doctor. They call it doctor in Colombia, but it can be whatever, an engineer, a sorcerer, I don't know. A doctor from his town that had helped them a lot along the way. And the doctor agreed to be his godfather and to choose his name. And he came up with this Egan name that apparently in some indigenous language means winner or champion. But Egan Bernal's mother wasn't quite happy with that name. And as she was walking to register his son before the Colombian authorities, he went past a photo shop and saw in there a frame with the brand Arley. And straight away, without telling anyone nothing, she registered Egan Bernal as Egan Arley.
Well, there you go.
Stunning, isn't it?
It's great. It's a great anecdote. Listen, Fran, changing subject completely this morning.
Aren't we going?
Well,
I
think we've exhausted
further?
That. I'm not sure we can go any further with that. I think we've established Egan Bernal's name, where it came from, the origins of it. That's good to know. But this morning, you made your debut as a Kilometer Zero man, producer, maker, star of, and your Kilometer Zero on Sierra Nevada was released. It was we followed you riding some of the mountains that the Vuelta will tackle on Sunday.
The actual course.
And yeah. You spoke to some riders, Adam Yates, Luis Angel Mate,
Tomas Marcinski,
double stage winner,
yes, Pachi Vila,
yep.
And also took out of my pocket one interview I had with Alejandro Valverde from last year,
Valverde.
Which he recounted how he lost one Vuelta in the descent from Monachil, which they are going to tackle this
week. Well, it was
Sunday.
A very interesting listen. I really enjoyed it. We've got Lionel Bernie playing Alejandro Valverde in that episode. Let's hear a little excerpt from it now.
Listen to Kilometer Zero, our morning show at the Vuelta a España, by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com.
After climbing for 10 minutes up this gradient, it kind of feels like every road in life is this steep.
This amazing place is, I think, the best place in Europe for training.
Road is good, training is good.
It's a nice place, you know. You have good weather, you have nice facilities up there, and it's easy to get in. I personally think that it's one of the best places to train, probably, in the world.
Yeah, an excellent Kilometer Zero, Fran, and you can become a friend of the podcast for £10 at thecyclingpodcast.com. Your support through that is very much appreciated, and you do get lots of great, we think, content.
The Harley, the Egan Harley Burnett, I presume it's not because he's related to Matthew Harley Goss.
No, that, I mean, yeah, you missed the very end of the
11,
story, but we're not going to get Fran to say it again. You can listen to the podcast.
There are a few good stories like this, aren't there? Like, who is the rider? It escapes me at the moment. There's a rider who's named after a character in Miami Vice. In fact, I've got it. It's Sonny Colbrelli. Yeah.
Wow.
Cracking story.
Great stuff. Yeah, no, that's a really good one. Well, I remember a few of you have been asking about our music that we play at the Vuelta. We played the same track last year, Mas y Mas. Agarate? Is it a track?
Agarate
is the track. You heard some...
Garate is a Canon del DS. This is
Agate. Yeah, okay. It's not a tribute to the Canon del DS. But there's another track of theirs also features in your Kilometer Zero, and it's very nice music indeed.
Fran, what are we going to eat tonight? And we're going to find any movida in Sevilla?
Well, not here, I think. Not here in Triana. But we can head to a neighbor nearby.
You promised the biggest dance floor in Spain, in Granada.
In Granada. But you are not staying tomorrow in Granada. Come on. I'm sure you were going to enjoy it, you know, but... Shamefully, I am the only one here who is going to enjoy it.
Shameful, exactly, shameful. What about food? Quickly.
Yeah, food here, it's the typical Andalusian one, gazpacho and so on. But there are some nice typical restaurants around here. So we will get to have a great dinner tonight.
It's a very nice little neighborhood.
I must say, Rich, I've been absolutely blown away by Andalusia last 2 days. There's been a lot of driving on this Vuelta, full stop.
Yeah.
But the last 2 days, I mean, today we drove 300 kilometers, but it was a fantastic tour of Andalusia, really. I imagine probably on some of the roads that the Ruta del Sol uses every year, but the landscapes have been absolutely jaw-dropping.
And the villages, you know, the place we stayed last night was outstanding. Very remote villages, very, very poor roads. I mean, the road just disappeared in places, and you were, you know, on gravel and dirt. And it was, I was thinking, could you take bike races around there? We were actually talking last night about why all the teams train just around the corner up the other coast rather than the Costa del Sol.
Well, here is a question, Fran. Why are there not more teams that hold training camps or have held training camps in Andalusia?
Well, I think your punctures speak for themselves.
Wow. Well, I've seen some pretty good roads.
Yeah, there are some pretty good roads, but if you go down to the coast from Malaga up to Huelva, the roads are quite saturated with traffic, the population is very dense. The eastern part of Andalusia, with the coast of Granada, the coast of Almeria, is way better. And indeed, Lotto and El Jumbo, for example, does have his training, their training camps in Mojácar, a town in eastern Almeria. Problem is the logistics, because there aren't good airports nearby. The good ones are Malaga and Alicante, which are a three-hour drive to Almeria, more or less. And I think that's the main reason why they choose Calpi, for example, which is way closer to Alicante.
But we are starting in Malaga next year, the Vuelta, of course, so no doubt explore more of the roads. We should wrap things up for tonight. We do need to go and find dinner. Daniel, good luck with the car tomorrow.
Thanks very much.
I wish you an incident-free day.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Fran.
Thank you all.